Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In May 1804, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark headed upstream on the Missouri River on one of the greatest expeditions of discovery in American history. They led a small band of men and one woman across the uncharted wilderness of the American West. Talking History's Fred Nielsen discusses that famous inland voyage this week with historian James Rhonda. And after that, Catherine Moore offers us her thoughts on the controversy surrounding Meriwether Lewis's death. Was it homicide or suicide? But first, in another in his series, A Moment in Time, Dan Roberts takes us back to 1791 and the designing of what was to become the nation's capital.
Despite his obvious brilliance, dealing with the designer of the District of Columbia, Pierre L'Enfant, was tough going. He did not last much beyond a year.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
From his arrival in America, French engineer Pierre Charles L'Enfant earned a reputation for brilliant design, careful construction, and prickly personality. When the deal was cut to place the new federal city in the South, George Washington chose Pierre L'Enfant to lay it out. In mid-March 1791, L'Enfant began surveying the tract, which was in a geographical depression at the juncture of the Potomac and Anacostia rivers. His plan called for avenues 160 feet broad and a huge mall extending west from the base of Jenkins Hill, the future location of the Capitol building. Instead of laying out streets while running survey lines, he connected dominating sites. A capitol on the promontory, the president's house on flat, low ground. And as his unique contribution to urban planning, he laid radial avenues, which, theoretically at least, made travel within the city more efficient. Because of his personality, however, L'Enfant came into conflict with the people who were actually living there. Once he ordered a home torn down because it lay 7 feet within the survey lines of New Jersey Avenue. The homeowner, Daniel Carroll, happened to be the uncle of one of the commissioners of the federal district, which did little to endear the architect to his employers. In exasperation, Thomas Jefferson finally told Washington, L'Enfant must know there is a line beyond which he will not be suffered to go. Pierre L'Enfant lasted barely 1 year as architect of the federal city, but the basic outline of his plan remains to this day. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
2 centuries ago this month, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark set out from St. Louis on their epic voyage of discovery. In the end, they failed in their primary goal to find a waterway to the Pacific, but they succeeded in opening the eyes of a nation to a land it had never seen and would help chart the course of its future. Fred Nielsen talked about the Lewis and Clark expedition with historian James Rhonda by phone at his home in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
William Clark called his expedition a vast enterprise. 200 years later, the scholarly investigation of Lewis and Clark is itself a vast undertaking. And perhaps no one has undertaken more of that task than my guest, James Rhonda. Rhonda, the Barnard Chair in Western History at the University of Tulsa, is a specialist in the exploration of the American West. His numerous books include Lewis and Clark Among the Indians and Voyages of Discovery, a collection of essays on the Lewis and Clark expedition. Rhonda has served as a consultant for numerous museum projects, including the Library of Congress Lewis and Clark Exploration Exhibition. Professor Rhonda, welcome.
Good morning. It's a delight and pleasure to be with you this morning.
The Lewis and Clark Expedition was Thomas Jefferson's idea. Clark called him the main character. What did Jefferson hope to accomplish?
Well, I think one way to begin to answer that question is to talk about what Jefferson didn't want them to do. Textbook wisdom always says that Lewis and Clark went west to explore the Louisiana Purchase. Of course, that's exactly what they weren't supposed to do. The expedition was planned long before the Louisiana Purchase. Jefferson was very clear to Lewis and Clark, but certainly to Lewis, about what this expedition was all about. In June 1803, when Thomas Jefferson wrote exploration instructions for Meriwether Lewis, he said very clearly that the object of your mission is to find the most direct and practical water communication across this continent for the purposes of commerce. Now, that's Thomas Jefferson's way to talk about the Northwest Passage. Nothing is more powerful and more elusive in the history of the geographic exploration of North America than the Northwest Passage, that notion that there was a water communication between Atlantic and the Pacific. From the age of Columbus to Thomas Jefferson and beyond, this was the great dream, that a water passage could be found. So this expedition has one central core mission: find the Northwest Passage. And interestingly enough, during the first winter outside of St. Louis, when Meriwether Lewis suggests that maybe it would be interesting for him to take a little side trip towards Santa Fe, Thomas Jefferson quickly and sharply reins him in and says, no, your mission is single. Find the water passage. So at the heart of this journey is a central core mission. Find the Northwest Passage. But Lewis and Clark didn't go into the West wearing intellectual blinders. Jefferson always believed that exploration had one mission and then many of secondary missions. And when we read the instructions, we can find a long list of those secondary missions. Everything from astronomy and botany to zoology to ethnography to commercial relationships with native people. So there's a core mission, and then there are the secondary missions. And then after the Louisiana Purchase is announced, there's a slight change in the instructions. Now Lewis and Clark have a particular diplomatic mission among native people, and that's to announce the presence of a new great father. So Jefferson had a core mission, many secondary missions, and then after the purchase, a new diplomatic mission as well. This is a fairly grand undertaking, to find the passage, to do all of these other things. This suggests a kind of flexible program for exploration that Lewis and Clark are given by Thomas Jefferson.
Jefferson was, of course, an 18th century man of science, and you've written that for its time, the Lewis and Clark expedition was what would come to be known as big science, involving several institutions, many specialists, and substantial funding.
Well, I think the real model for this, because Jefferson had read widely in the history of exploration, and he looked especially at what the British were doing, because this is not the age of Lewis and Clark. This is the age of Cook and Vancouver. And Jefferson looked at what the British were doing in the Pacific Ocean. He looked particularly at one person, at Sir Joseph Banks. Banks was the president of the Royal Society. He was the principal scientific advisor to the government of George III. And what the British had done was to build a very complex, well-funded, highly structured model for global exploration. And Thomas Jefferson would attempt to do that same sort of thing. I've often talked about this as the people who made the journey and then those folks who made the journey possible. And we should focus especially on those folks who make the journey possible. They're the ones who helped Jefferson write the instructions, members of his cabinet, scientific friends in Philadelphia. But there are also a whole nother group of folks, the ordinary craftsmen and artisans in Philadelphia and other places who don't make the journey, but who make the journey possible. I was thinking the other day about one particular person. Her name was Matilda Chapman, and she sewed the shirts for the expedition in Philadelphia. And she reminds me over and over again of all of those craftsmen and craftswomen who made those things that the journey would really be built on. So this is a large, complex structure, a large organization, people who make the journey, people who make the journey possible. And then, of course, there are what happens when the journey returns. And all of those folks who are going to look at the maps, at the specimens, at the journals, and think through what this journey is all about. A long time ago, Donald Jackson said that it was no longer useful to think about the journey of Lewis and Clark as the story of two men. And what I've tried to do in my writing is to give this story a large cast of characters and to give it a continental and even perhaps a global stage. So not just two men, but many characters, those who make the journey, those who make the journey possible.
I like the way you describe the men who accompanied Lewis and Clark on the expedition. Your words are, they're a wild bunch of hard-drinking, brawling, and insubordinate rowdies. Doesn't sound very promising.
Well, I think they're a bunch of tough customers. And if you think about where Lewis and Clark recruited those who were going to go along with them, some of them indeed come from frontier infantry companies. They are soldiers. But some of them are French boatmen, and then some of them are frontier hunters. So they come from disparate and different social groups. And what Lewis, Clark, and the senior sergeant, John Ordway. What these three men need to do is to create what, in military terms, is called unit cohesion. What they need to do is to create a military community, what Meriwether Lewis would eventually call the best of families. That's a very interesting phrase, the best of families. And that didn't happen automatically. It was a long, hard struggle to weld together these often difficult and rowdy characters into something that would be cohesive, a unit that would understand its mission, and then work together for the common good. And if we look at how they did that, first, they do it by imposing military discipline, by the rules and regulations, the culture of a military unit. But that's not enough. This group is going to work only if it has shared common experiences. The experiences of living together, working together, eating together, sharing a common life. And that's really what happens in that first year, is that this tough bunch of characters, I don't know that necessarily they have the right stuff right away. They need to find the common center. They need to find the common ground. They need to have a shared life. And that's really what happens in that first year, in that shakedown cruise up the Missouri from St. Louis to Fort Mandan. They learn to live together as a human community. And I like to tell my students that's what this expedition is. It's a human community that comes to know itself.
It also comes to know other people. One of Jefferson's secondary missions, of course, is to establish diplomatic relations with the Indians. What preconceptions did he and what preconceptions did Lewis and Clark, too, for that matter, have about the Native Americans?
I think the images cover a wide range. On one hand, Jefferson sometimes thought about Native people as children living at the dawn of time. And if you wanted to understand something about the origins of European civilization, you ought to look at the way Native people live, because Jefferson believed in a kind of social evolution, that all human societies began as hunting societies and then, in his mind, progressed eventually to the most perfect societies, farming societies. So Jefferson thought sometimes that Native people were children living at the dawn of time. So that's on one end of the spectrum. They're children who eventually might, so Jefferson hoped, commit cultural suicide and then become just like their European neighbors. On the other end of that, there are much harder, much tougher, much more violent images. Images of Native people as treacherous savages. And Meriwether Lewis oftentimes talks about Indians in terms of that one word, treachery. He draws on images from the violence of the Ohio Country Indian Wars of the 1780s, of the dark and bloody ground. And he'll talk about Indians as being treacherous savages, as being beasts. So we've got a full range of images here. But I think it's also important when we talk about images that these images oftentimes break down, and that on the journey, members of the expedition encounter Native people as human beings, and that they relate one to the other as human beings, sharing a common life, sharing a game, sharing a song, sharing a story, sharing a meal, giving gifts to each other. So while I always think it's important to understand preconceptions, images that exist before the journey, lots of times those images break down as one human being encounters and talks to and meets with another human being. But what we've got here is a full range of preconceptions.
Let's take it from the other directions. You've written that, in a sense, Lewis and Clark were exploring the Indians, but the Indians were exploring them as well.
Right. I think that's really what's going on here. I think that's the heart of the story, is that this is mutual encounter, this is mutual discovery, and that if Lewis and Clark and the others in the traveling party are explorers, then we need to get off the boat and get on the bank, and we need to see this through the eyes of Native explorers, Lewis and Clark are the strange countries. They're the strangers. How do we explore them? Native people in different parts of the American West had had a lot of experience with outsiders, with strangers, with Euro-Americans. And so the response to the presence of Lewis and Clark is always based on previous experience. Mandans and Hidatsas up in present-day North Dakota around the Knife River had had a lot of experience with Euro-American outsiders. And so they're going to have one set of reactions. They will, by the way, be very surprised about one kind of outsider they'd never seen. They'd never seen an African-American. They'd never seen anyone like York. So they'll be very surprised about that. In the center of the journey with the Shoshones, the Lemhi Shoshones had not seen these Euro-American outsiders. So there was real surprise and real wonder about these strangers. Then on the Northwest Coast, among the Chinooks, among the Clatsops, they too had seen strangers. They'd seen the maritime fur traders. They were a little concerned about these strangers are coming from the wrong direction. They're coming from the Columbia, not from the ocean. But they too had seen outsiders before. So when we think about Native people as explorers, because that's what they are, we always need to ask, what were the previous experiences that they'd had with outsiders, with strangers? And what are the strategies that Native American explorers use to explore Lewis and Clark? Everything from visiting, trading, talking, looking, and maybe even intimate encounters as well. Again, I like to talk about this story as the American encounter, as mutual exploration.
Sacagawea is, for a lot of people, I think, one of the most famous American women. How does the historical record match the myth?
I think the historical record is fairly thin about her. We know some things, and I'm afraid that very often, because we're so eager to know about her, she is such a compelling young person, this young mother with a child who makes the journey, that oftentimes we fill in the spaces with myth and with story and an invention. She is important, and she's important on a couple of levels. She's important first in a geographic sense because at key moments she identifies important geographic points. She's been to the Three Forks of the Missouri. That's part of her home country. She identifies as a guide a couple of key places. And then, of course, she's a language interpreter among her own people, the Lemhi Shoshones. And then there's something else, something that William Clark talks about. Her very presence, her physical presence, says to Native people that these travelers are not warriors, because a war party would never take along a woman and a child. And so her physical presence is important. And also, one of the rare moments when we hear her voice, when they're on the Pacific Ocean and a great whale is beached, and she wants to go and see that whale, because this is the great fish, and she makes it clear that she's made this journey along with them, and now it's her opportunity to see the ocean and to see the whale, because after all, as she says, I've made this journey, and I want to see this great thing. And that's an interesting moment when we can actually hear the voice of this young woman and her own curiosity about the world around her. You know, I think that in many ways she is a symbol for all of the women, both Native and non-Native, who make this journey possible, whether it's someone like Matilda Chapman or the Nez Perce woman, Watkuwis, who tells the Nez Perce to do Lewis and Clark no harm, or the Shoshone women who carry the baggage across the continental divide. Sacagawea reminds us that this is not just a guy story. This is not, oh, beautiful for spacious guys. That this is a story of both men and women. And she's a powerful reminder of that, I think.
Well, Professor Rhonda, thanks so much for visiting with us this morning.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with James Rhonda, the author of numerous books about Lewis and Clark, including Lewis and Clark Among the Indians and Beyond Lewis and Clark, The Army Explores the West.
In September 1809, only a few short years after his return from his famous expedition, Meriwether Lewis departed St. Louis for Washington, D.C. He never made it. He died en route. But how he died remains the subject of a considerable debate. Our guest commentator this week, Catherine Moore, revisits that controversy.
Desiring to justify related expenses from his recent expedition to the Pacific to certain bureaucrats and congressmen, Governor Meriwether Lewis of the Louisiana Territory left St. Louis to travel to Washington, D.C. in September 1809. As Lewis and a servant journeyed downriver, Lewis fell ill with a recurrent case of malaria, a disease whose symptoms can mimic insanity, including paranoia and delirium. Lewis stayed at Fort Pickering, site of present-day Memphis, under the watchful eye of its commander, Captain Gilbert Russell. Upon feeling himself sufficiently recovered to resume his journey, he decided to travel overland to Nashville via the Natchez Trace. Once in Nashville, he could take a stage east. Robbers, thieves, and highwaymen roamed the Natchez Trace prowling for easy marks. Knowing of its dangerous reputation, Lewis knew he would require an escort. Captain Russell wanted to accompany Lewis, but his commander, General James Wilkinson, refused. However, a newly appointed Indian agent in Wilkinson's employ suddenly appeared. James Neely volunteered to go with his own servant, and on the 29th of September, the four well-armed men left Fort Pickering. Apparently, the journey proved non-eventful until the morning of October 10th, when the men rose to find some of their horses missing. They decided to split up, with Lewis riding ahead and Neely agreeing to meet him at the next inn or stand. Stories differ wildly as to what transpired next. Lewis may have ridden to the stand alone or with servants. He inquired of the mistress, Mrs. Grinder, if it was a public house. She affirmed this and provided him a cabin across from hers. Later that night, two or three shots rang out. Mrs. Grinder said she heard a noise as if someone were crawling. Then she heard Lewis's voice begging for water. Afraid of danger outside, Mrs. Grinder refused to help him and left him to painfully drag himself back to his cabin. In daylight, Mrs. Grinder visited him and found him wounded in the chest and head. Servants who may or may not have been present claimed that Lewis said, "I have done the business." He soon breathed his last. Sometime later, Neely arrived. His account of Lewis's death as a suicide was accepted by both Thomas Jefferson and William Clark, thus ensuring Neely's account as the final word. However, for those believing this version, Meriwether Lewis emerges as one of the most inept suicides ever. In attempting to end his life, this expert in firearms apparently just grazed his forehead, shot his chest, or perhaps abdomen or side, then reloaded in order to fire again. Some versions then depict the medical officer of the Lewis and Clark expedition unable to locate a vital artery while slashing wildly with his razor. Remarkably, many say this is the most plausible explanation for his death. For those convinced it was murder, suspects abound. Lewis's mother believed his servant killed her son. Mrs. Grinder's story seemed to change every time she told it. The general suspicion of the area was that her husband, who was supposedly gone that day, had committed the deed as part of a robbery. Captain Russell insinuated that Neely himself might have murdered Lewis. Some believe that General James Wilkinson, whose activities often were illegal and traitorous, might have enlisted as Agent Neely to kill Lewis, fearing Lewis knew too much and wanted to prevent his arrival in Washington. Perhaps the National Park Service summarizes the situation best when it states that Grinder Stan, Meriwether Lewis, died of gunshot wounds under mysterious circumstances.
You've been listening to Catherine Moore, the author of The Lost Years of Meriwether Lewis, which appeared in the summer 2003 issue of the Journal of the West. This is Talking History. And finally, we continue with our reading of another passage from the unpublished diary of J.C. Wilmarth, Union soldier from Massachusetts. Wilmarth has been captured and imprisoned in the Andersonville prison in Georgia. June 11th. Raiders roamed last night. We call them that. They are Union prisoners banded together for the purpose of robbery. Some of the boys have a good deal of money, and these raiders go to their tent at night and order them to give it all up under penalty of death. They got clubbed by our crowd and drove away. Had our meat stole by Hayes. One of the squad found it in his haversack, shaved his head, half of it, bucked and gagged him. He won't steal any more meat, I don't think. We take the law into our own hands to be trodden underfoot and our rights stolen from us. Rough place, and willing to cry enough. Sunday, June 12th. No one would realize that this was the Sabbath day. I wish I could describe it. Fighting, swearing, and stealing all day. Men completely destitute of any clothing, skin and bones, walking round camp in hope to find something in the filth of the camp to satisfy their craving appetite. No shelter from the burning sun or the cold, damp air of night, except one who is fortunate enough to have some old blanket too poor for the rebels to steal from us. Not one-third in this place have a place to lay their heads, except in the streets. A man was killed outright today. He was clubbed to death by a fellow prisoner. It commenced by talk and ended in a fight as usual in this place. Wish I was out of this. It's the hardest thing of soldiering, the prison life. Don't see any signs of getting out of it. June 15th. A man was round today who was hired by the rebels to find what shoemakers there was in camp to get them to go outside and make shoes for the rebel army. Did not get very far before he was seized, and one half of his hair and whiskers shaved off, making him look very comical. Very amusing to the lookers-on, but rather disgracing to the unprincipled shoemaker. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OEH, visit our website at oeh.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.